vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the July 2nd, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: the U.S. declined to extend its signature trade pact with Mexico and Canada, setting up a decade-long review process that cast uncertainty over businesses that move goods across the world's busiest export borders. Elon Musk's SpaceX has developed a prototype for a handset-like device designed to reshape how humans interact with artificial intelligence that SpaceX has shown investors recently. A pullback in shares of chip makers weighed on the NASDAQ, which fell 0.7% and left the S&P 500 0.2% lower. The Dow fell less than 0.1% lower from a record. Bending Spoons, an Italian tech company that bought up brands including AOL, made its stock market debut at a valuation of more than $18 billion. Shares gained 40% from its IPO price. McKinsey is shaking up its board and appointing a new chair from within its partner ranks. A Swedish court ordered Alphabet's Google to pay Klarna $1.97 billion in damages after the buy now, pay later company won an antitrust case. Crypto exchange Binance failed to obtain a license to operate in the EU after a regulator expressed concerns about its history of financial crime violations. Paramount Skydance offered the EU's merger watchdog concessions to ease competition concerns over its takeover of Warner Brothers Discovery. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. Persian Gulf entities paid about $300 million to President Trump's businesses last year, more than any other foreign region identifiable in his financial disclosures, which detailed more than $2 billion in revenue across his businesses. Trump took his maiden flight on his new Air Force One, a Boeing 747-8 luxury jet given to the U.S. by the Qatari government. The Supreme Court has wrapped up one of its most consequential terms in decades, delivering sweeping wins and losses to Trump, while marching forward with long-held priorities of the conservative legal movement. Influenza and pneumonia are among the top 10 causes of death in the U.S., even as the nation's overall death rate in 2025 fell to its lowest point on record, according to data from the CDC. Former CIA Director John Brennan sued the Trump administration to force officials to preserve records from criminal probes targeting him. Senator Elizabeth Warren asked the Fed's Inspector General to review whether the Vice Chair for Bank Supervision violated the rules by speaking at a private dinner for Bank of America clients. British police officers who handcuffed and arrested a stabbing victim as he lay dying are being investigated for potential gross misconduct. A fire at an Ohio motel killed three people. A Democratic socialist defeated a longtime Colorado congresswoman, and Senator Michael Bennett lost his gubernatorial bid to the state's combative attorney general in the state's Democratic primary. Two people were arrested after scaling the Empire State Building. Died Victor Willis, 74, Village People co-founder. The picture on today's front page shows President Trump pointing to his new Air Force One. And that headline reads, Qatari gift makes maiden flight as Air Force One. The caption, new ride. President Trump heads for his first trip on a jet Qatar donated to the U.S., which gave it a $400 million overhaul. The article, Qatari gifted Air Force One put in service, by Meredith McGraw and Marcus Weisgerber. Aboard Air Force One, a new paint job, lie-flat leather seats, and library cases. President Trump on Wednesday took his maiden flight on his long-awaited new Air Force One, a Boeing 747-8 luxury jet that was given to the U.S. by the Qatari government. A Wall Street Journal reporter was among a small group of reporters on the trip. The jet has undergone a $400 million overhaul to equip it with state-of-the-art security and technology for the president, such as a new communication system. The renovation also included some alterations to the lavish interiors of the Qatari royal family's private plane. The president pored over exterior designs for the plane, which replaces the old Air Force One signature white and baby blue color scheme with a red, white, navy, and gold paint job that resembles the look of Trump's personal jet. The press cabin of the new plane is more spacious than it was on the previous Air Force One, filling the back corner of the jet. Senior White House staff and security officials sit in a separate area nearby. The only channel available on the televisions on Wednesday, Fox News. The president landed in North Dakota on Wednesday for the opening of the Theodore Roosevelt's Presidential Library. Quote, this will be the first flight of what I think is maybe the greatest commercial plane ever built, Trump told reporters Wednesday morning before boarding. The new plane will be in temporary use until two presidential aircraft that have long been delayed are delivered. The jet replaces the Boeing 747-200 aircraft that had served as Air Force One since George H.W. Bush's presidency. The plane was donated to the U.S. by the Qatari government last year after Trump complained that the presidential planes he flew on were too old and small. Trump has dismissed criticism over the donation, including concerns from both Democrats and Republicans about the ethics and national security implications of accepting the plane. You can't do two things. You can low-key it or you can show it. And I think the country should be very proud of it, Trump said. Articles from the front page follow. President is raking in cash from deals in the Middle East. Payments from the region in 2025 were $300 million, mostly from a crypto sale. By Elliot Brown. The Middle East has been good for President Trump's bottom line. Entities from the Gulf paid around $300 million to the president's businesses last year, more than any other foreign region identifiable in his financial disclosures released Tuesday, which detailed more than $2 billion in revenue across his businesses. By far the largest chunk from the region, Trump got $263 million from the sale of half his stake in cryptocurrency company World Liberty Financial, according to the documents. The Wall Street Journal in January reported the previously secret deal was with an entity backed by the Sheikh Tanun bin Saeed Al Nahyan, a top royal in the United Arab Emirates, who is brother to the country's president. The remainder of the Gulf money came from two Middle East developers who have launched a flurry of Trump-branded towers and golf courses in the region in the past 3 years. The haul of cash by a sitting president is unique and presents the U.S. public with a stark new reality of White House occupant who has great political power and wealth from a business empire open to deal-making. It is also a remarkable turnaround in fortunes for Trump, who just 2 years ago, the year he won a second term, faced a massive cash call from judgments in civil lawsuits. The payments came from a region that sits at the center of Trump's foreign policy. Trump launched a war against Iran, has been a stalwart backer of Israel's campaign in Gaza, and has pushed rich Arab nations to invest heavily in the U.S. In 2025, the year the report covers, the wealthiest Middle East governments eagerly embraced the new administration. Qatar gave the president a plane as a gift, which recently entered service as Air Force One. That country, along with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, committed to major investment deals in the U.S. The cryptocurrency sale, a deal struck 4 days before the 2025 inauguration, and other payments to Trump and close advisors are how things have worked for a very long time in the Gulf, said David Schenker, who was the State Department's top Middle East official during Trump's first term. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. U.S. won't extend North American Trade Pact. Decision sets up a period of annual reviews, placing the agreement in doubt. By Santiago Perez in Mexico City, Gavin Bade in Washington, and Paul Vieira in Ottawa. The U.S. declined to extend its trade pact with Mexico and Canada on Wednesday, setting up a decade-long review process that casts uncertainty over businesses that move goods across the world's busiest export borders. The U.S. decision came as no surprise. President Trump has effectively ripped up parts of the U.S. Mexico-Canada trade agreement that he signed in his first administration, imposing tariffs on a range of goods. He has mused about terminating the agreement altogether. The United States did not agree to renew the USMCA in its current form, U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer said on Wednesday. The deadline for the three countries to extend the USMCA for 16 years, something Canada and Mexico were eager to do. The pact remains in effect, but now the U.S. refusal to renew means U.S. trade representatives will have to meet every year for a decade with Mexican and Canadian officials to review the deal. Negotiations can continue in the meantime. Greer said the U.S. will engage with Mexico and Canada to address the USMCA's shortcomings, chief among them narrowing the U.S. trade gap with its top trading partners. The pact, known in Canada as CUSMA and in Mexico as TMEC, underpins nearly $2 trillion in annual trade. Last year, combined U.S. exports to Mexico and Canada surpassed $670 billion, according to U.S. statistics. In comparison, U.S. exports to China last year amounted to about $106 billion. The U.S. is likely to renegotiate aspects of the deal, said Kelly Ann Shaw, who was deputy director of the National Economic Council during Trump's first term. That process will carry on throughout the rest of the summer, if not into the end of this year, she said. The eventual pact could look much different from the trilateral agreement that took effect in 2020, perhaps with separate addendums for Canada and Mexico, Shaw said. Uncertainty over the USMCA is holding back the economies of Mexico and Canada because companies can't make long-term investment plans without clear rules. Business investment in Canada has declined for five straight quarters, and hiring remains stagnant. Mexico's automotive sector has lost 100,000 jobs since 2025 because of the uncertainty. Mexico's economy minister, Marcelo Ebrard, has said the two rounds of bilateral trade talks held in recent weeks show that the U.S. is engaged in USMCA discussions. A third round is scheduled for later this month. High Court delivers a momentous term, by James Ramaser, Washington. The Supreme Court has wrapped up one of its most consequential terms in decades, delivering a mix of sweeping wins and losses to President Trump, while marching forward with long-held priorities of the conservative legal movement. Just 4 days before the U.S.'s 250th birthday, the High Court handed down the term's final and perhaps most historic decision, an affirmation of the broad understanding of U.S. citizenship. That capped a string of landmark rulings that reverberated through the nation's politics, its economy, and its relations with the rest of the world. For the past year, the court's docket was dominated by a president who pushed legal boundaries and sometimes lashed out when the court stepped in. At the same time, the justices were immersed in controversies over guns, immigration, voting rights, and gender identity, all of which exposed rifts on the court that reflect broader divisions across American life. Trump's combustible relationship with the courts has been a defining feature of his second term in office. The justices, so far, have given him much of what he asked for, but they have also drawn a few bright lines. Since Trump's return to the White House, the court's six-justice conservative majority has used short-form interim rulings to allow an array of his policies to quickly take effect, including on deportations, withholding of foreign aid, and layoffs of federal workers. Recently, the president began scoring long-term victories. Last week, the court affirmed Trump's broad authority to implement key aspects of his immigration crackdown. On Monday, in Trump's biggest win of the term, the court agreed with him that the president has inherent authority to control most policy-making agencies, even if Congress tried to shelter them from political pressure. But some big recent losses for Trump have piled up, too. The court rejected a lawsuit filed by the Republican Party and supported by the administration that would have disallowed some mail-in ballots during the 2026 midterm elections. The court rebuffed several other attempts by Trump, a Republican, to claim powers that no president before him has ever asserted. It struck down his global tariffs program, blocked him from remaking the Federal Reserve, and stopped him from denying citizenship to U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants or temporary visitors. Some legal commentators see Trump's mixed record as proof of the court's independence. Air conditioning polarizes Europe. Record heat challenges longstanding resistance, sparks political battles. By Matthew Dalton, Paris. Luca Fenaro, a 32-year-old with a rare genetic illness, suffered through this month's record-breaking heat wave in his apartment in the French capital without an air conditioning system. His neighbors won't allow one. They have refused his request to install a unit in the courtyard of his building in the Marais, a bustling neighborhood in central Paris. They said the device would be too loud. Fenaro, who relies on a wheelchair and breathes through a ventilator, has taken the neighbors to court, his family spending thousands of dollars on a legal battle that has lasted 2 years and counting. If it's too hot, disabled people get dehydrated and it's difficult to breathe, said Fenaro. Europeans have long shunned air conditioning, viewing it as noisy, a blight on their architectural heritage, and above all, unnecessary, as long as the summers were mild. They feared widespread adoption of energy-hungry technology would undermine their ambition to lead the fight against climate change. That resistance, however, is colliding with the realities of a continent where the temperatures are rising faster than any other region on the planet. Years of record-breaking heat waves have placed strains on the continent's health systems as well as its economy. Thousands of schools across Western Europe, which are rarely air-conditioned, shut down during the latest heat wave, forcing many parents to stay home. Businesses closed, factories cut back production, rail lines were suspended. Economists at the Dutch bank ING said the heat wave brought back memories of the pandemic lockdowns. The fight over the future of air conditioning is now shaping political debates across the continent, pitting politicians on the right, who want a massive plan to install air conditioning, against those on the left, who fear the environmental impact. Before celebrities marry, they deploy special ops. By Javi Lieber. The logistics of planning a wedding for a celebrity can sound a lot like warfare. Former Navy SEALs stationed at the door, German shepherds sniffing the perimeter, radio frequency jammers scrambling the Wi-Fi signal, drones that shoot down spying drones, locked and loaded. For the few high-profile people whose priority is secrecy, wedding security can be as complicated and expensive as the wedding itself. It feels like we are special ops, said Michelle Rago, a luxury events specialist who has planned weddings for people such as Brooklyn Peltz Beckham. It's a crazy world, and we have to be prepared for anything. When Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce get married, with chatter mounting that a celebration will take place this weekend at Madison Square Garden, the couple will need an ironclad security plan. Keeping things under wraps can involve multiple security teams, inner and outer circles of trust, and, in some cases, fake names and fake venues, industry insiders said. Representatives for Swift and Kelce didn't respond to request for comment. Leaving the front page, Team USA survives with 10 men to keep its World Cup run alive. Despite a second-half red card, the Americans sank Bosnia and Herzegovina 2-0 to advance. By Andrew Beaton and Joshua Robinson, Santa Clara, California. Before the U.S. national team's round of 32 games against Bosnia and Herzegovina on Wednesday, manager Mauricio Pochettino emphasized that the Americans understood their mortality at this tournament. No matter how heavily favored they were before kickoff, this game, he explained, was the final of the World Cup. And if we were capable to go through, he added, the next one is going to be another final of the World Cup. Now America can plan for at least one more at its home tournament after surviving the first of its do-or-die test at this tournament. The U.S. held on for a 2-0 victory over Bosnia at Levi's Stadium, despite being reduced to 10 men by a red card for the final half hour of the match. Serena Williams, 44, falls in rollicking return at Wimbledon. Serena Williams lost a three-set match to Maya Joint at Wimbledon by Jason Gay. Not a victory, but definitely not bad for 4 years off. Serena Williams had her moments Tuesday at Wimbledon. Some of her serves screeched like rockets. She hit a couple of sizzler forehands that found the lines. She saved a match point. She won a tiebreak. Williams clawed back a few times when she looked good and cooked. And when she did that, she let out a signature Serena, come on. In the end, Williams wound up falling 6-3, 6-7, 6, 6-3 to 20-year-old Maya Joint. But her first round performance wasn't close to cringe. If anything, it seemed like a signal of what might be possible in Williams' still nascent on-the-fly comeback at age 44. She has such an aura, said the triumphant joint, who plays for Australia, but was born and raised in Michigan. She's such a legend. You are listening to the reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, What the Founders Didn't Trust. Madison, Hamilton, et al. Would wonder at our credulous view of human nature. By Barton Swaim. Ponder a wonderful passage in Paul Johnson's A History of the American People, 1997, noting the dismal succession of non-entities to take the job of British Prime Minister from 1763 to 1782. Johnson observes that this might not have mattered quite so much if the men they faced across the Atlantic had been of ordinary stature, of average competence and character. As it was, the generation that emerged to lead the colonies into independence was one of the most remarkable group of men in history, sensible, broad-minded, courageous, usually well-educated, gifted in a variety of ways, mature and long-sighted, sometimes lit by flashes of genius. Johnson calls the American founders the Enlightenment made flesh, but an Enlightenment shorn of its vitiating French intellectual weaknesses of dogmatism, anti-clericalism, moral chaos, and an excessive trust in logic. Such a collection of statesmen might have been expected to create a government rooted in the doctrine that man naturally seeks the good. The French, under the spell of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, built their revolution on this theory that man comes into the world pure and only encounters moral defilement from society. The triumph of the American founders lies in their having done the opposite. The doctrine of original sin and its implication that humans tend toward rank self-interest and degeneracy animated every part of the constitutional structure the founders erected. Arguments about the depth of their religious convictions miss the point. Even the skeptics and deists among them, of whom there were few, happily adopted Christianity's moral outlook. Spend the rest of this semi-quincentennial year reading the Federalist Papers and mark how often the authors, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison, base their contentions on the reality that fallen man can be counted on to conflate his own narrow interest with justice and the common good. The essays refer often to man's ingenuity and capacity for innovation and commerce. They didn't think him so stupid as to require coercion. But Hamilton, Jay, and Madison aimed chiefly to convince the public that the proposed Constitution, by balancing powers against each other, mitigated man's propensity for mischief, violence, and corruption. Madison famously observes in number 51 that government's existence itself testifies to the morally defective state of its subjects. If men were angels, no government would be necessary, he writes. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place oblige it to control itself. Or Hamilton, in number 15, Why has government been instituted at all? Because the passions of men will not conform to the dictates of reason and justice without constraint. Roughly the past 125 years of American government have departed from the founders' self-understanding. Woodrow Wilson and his progressive heirs created an assemblage of government agencies whose technocratic managers bore no accountability to elected leaders. The expansion of social welfare programs, begun by the New Deal and supercharged by the Great Society, hypothesized that recipients would use the dole as a chance to get ahead rather than a way to avoid productivity. American leaders in this period negotiated agreements with hostile foreign powers, Russia, North Korea, Iran, in the belief that generous treatment by the U.S. would coax those powers into better behavior. Socialism, rose-tinted as ever, beckons again today. America's founders, to a man, as I suspect, would have viewed 20th and 21st century politics as a long series of gambles that human nature might suddenly repair itself. Some number of influencers on the American right, variously called post-liberals or national conservatives, want to use industrial and social welfare policy, formerly instruments of the left, for allegedly conservative ends. They place more faith in human nature than the founders did. A note of hope. The Supreme Court this week signaled its sympathy with the founders' distrust of human nature by overturning Humphrey's Executor versus the U.S., the 1935 decision that endorsed the creation of all those independent, expert-led federal agencies. The post-religious belief in humanity's essential goodness, together with the loss of any understanding of sin, quaint word, was supposed to lead to a gentler, less judgmental world. It has done the opposite. Reject the doctrine of man's depravity if you like. The world's abundance of depravity still demands explanation. The revolutionaries in France explained it by making clergy, nobles, and monarchy the sources of everybody's woes. The Marxists blamed the bourgeoisie and capitalist. Their descendants today, similarly bereft of any conception of fallenness, pin the world's ills on people who hold the wrong political views. When the authors of the Federalist Papers spoke of the passions of men, or of men consistently failing to behave like angels, they acknowledged themselves too as passion-prone and defective. The old understanding of man as inherently flawed had a humbling and leveling effect, just as the rejection of it has encouraged political actors across the West to treat their opponents as subhuman spreaders of evil. To recover a saner, less embittered politics may be as simple and as difficult as recovering the Founding Fathers' anthropology. Heritage Americans, an un-American idea. Today our nation is more than an idea, but 250 years ago, an idea was all it was, by Carl Rove. It hangs where I see it every day I'm home. The years have taken their toll. The paper has turned brown. The words have faded. It's one of the last remnants of my childhood, a gift from my taciturn Norwegian father. He sometimes read the Declaration aloud on Independence Day. I was especially taken by the sentence that begins, We hold these truths to be self-evident. Those truths still hold and should still stir every American. The historian Gordon Wood put it well. The revolution that the Declaration announced radically and thoroughly transformed American society. It destroyed aristocracy, made the interest and prosperity of ordinary people the goal of society and government, and released powerful popular entrepreneurial and commercial energies. America wasn't built by the rich and powerful, but in large part by discards, rejects, losers, and throwaways who made their way here. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore, Emma Lazarus wrote in her 1883 sonnet, later inscribed on the Statue of Liberty's pedestal. Inspired by the Declaration, people have come over the centuries hoping life could be better. Abide by its principles and the Constitution written to secure them. The promise went, and you in America can flourish. We have. What began as pioneers huddled on a narrow coastal strip, an ocean away from the civilization they knew and facing an immense unknown land, is now a mighty nation that spans a continent. America has become the most prosperous, compassionate, innovative, open society the world has known. Despite our challenges, doubts, and divisions, America still demonstrates every day what a free people can achieve for their families and the nation if we strive to make the Declaration's words real. Who wants to leave home for the nations that reject outright the principles of our founding documents? Instead, many still want to come here. I was once in Abuja, Nigeria, and a cab driver asked where I was from. Like all Lone Star chauvinists, I said Texas. He replied, "Ah, America. I want the American dream." I asked what he meant. Dream big, work hard, and rise. He sounded like Abraham Lincoln, who, according to the historian Gabor Borat, believed in the right to rise. Creating America wasn't easy, and the fulfillment of our founding documents still demands much. But we make a grave mistake if we think this nation is only for what some call heritage Americans, whose forebears, specifically Anglo and Scot-Irish Protestants, fought in the Revolution or Civil War. This notion that there is a select subset of real Americans is being pushed by, among others, Vice President J.D. Vance. He says that America is not just an idea, but a particular place with a particular people. Our country is more than an idea, but it began as one. Our people are particular, yet it makes no difference whether your forebear wintered at Valley Forge or fought at Gettysburg. What matters is living up to the Declaration's promises. It is ironic that Mr. Vance, a Catholic convert, would advocate heritage Americans. In the past, such movements routinely declared Catholics unacceptable members of our national family. One of the largest such groups was the American Protective Association, an anti-immigrant organization in the Gilded Age. It claimed 2.5 million adherents at its height. Its members swore an oath denouncing the Pope and the diabolical work of the Roman Catholic Church. The APA was particularly strong in Mr. Vance's home state of Ohio. This notion of heritage Americans is at odds with the Declaration. America's birth didn't include a new aristocracy based on inherited valor. Consider some Americans without Revolution or Civil War forebears. Elon Musk, Google CEO Sundar Pichai, NVIDIA co-founder Jensen Huang, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Charlize Theron, Hakeem Olajuwon, former Pepsi CEO Indra Nooyi, Albert Einstein, Nikola Tesla, Salma Hayek, Henry Kissinger, Oracle Safra Katz, Bob Hope, Irving Berlin, Interactive Brokers founder Thomas Peterfee, Yo-Yo Ma, Alex Trebek, and at least 40 winners of the Nobel Prize for Medicine. 1 in 7 American residents is an immigrant. For the other 6, this Saturday should be a day for special gratitude. Through no action of our own, we were born here, and alongside all who made their difficult way to America, enjoy the blessings of what happened in Philadelphia in the summer of 1776. Happy 4th to every American. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Democrats need to show our love for America. Ceding patriotism to the GOP does a disservice to our party and, more important, to our nation. By Tom Suozzi. I love America. Unfortunately, as we celebrate our nation's 250th birthday, too many Americans associate those 3 words only with Republicans. Democrats need to change that. Many in my party are unhappy with the nation's current trajectory. Under President Trump, we've fallen short on income inequality. We've seen masked agents go head-to-head with U.S. citizens. Our elections and voting rights have been attacked, while misinformation proliferates online amid bigotry, extremism, and political violence. Despite all this, we should remain fiercely proud of the American system. It has enabled the quest for a more perfect union, making possible the abolition of slavery, the rights of women and Black Americans to vote, the protection of civil rights, the confrontation of religious, ethnic, and racial bigotry, and so much more. Patriotism doesn't ask us to whitewash the country's shortcomings. It requires us to confront them honestly while recognizing that our Constitution, our democratic institutions, and generations of courageous citizens have given us the ability to correct our mistakes. Democrats have long believed that America is great, not because it is perfect, but because it has the capacity to become better. We must reclaim the language of patriotism because our history teaches us the most American thing any of us can do is help our great nation live up to the ideals charted by our founders 250 years ago. Liberty, equality, democracy, and the rule of law. Our authoritarian adversaries suppress dissent and erase uncomfortable truths. America has repeatedly expanded liberty, broadened opportunity, and moved closer to fulfilling the promise that all people are created equal. That's why generations of Democrats have stood proudly at the helm of some of the most consequential struggles to shape American life. Democrats supported the rise of organized labor. Democrats gave us the 40-hour work week and worker protections. Democrats created Social Security and Medicare. Democrats championed civil rights. Democrats pushed for major environmental protections. And it is Democrats who must now lead us patriotically into the future. We must rebuild the American middle class. But we can't do this by abandoning capitalism. Only by improving capitalism can we reward hard work and expand opportunity for every American who seeks it. Capitalism has helped make America the most innovative and prosperous nation in the world. It has lifted living standards, created opportunity, and helped build the strongest middle class in history. It has powered breakthroughs from the light bulb to the microchip and fueled the ingenuity that defines our nation. But capitalism works only when it is shaped by fair rules, open competition, and the basic sense of responsibility. The answer to inequality isn't to tear capitalism down, but to make it work better for the men and women who go to work every day and want to live the American dream of home ownership, educated children, affordable health insurance, and a safe retirement. Patriotism means recognizing that America has been a force for good. The American Revolution wasn't only a victory for the 13 colonies. It fueled struggles for independence, democracy, and self-determination from Europe to Latin America. Across centuries, America's example and leadership have also shaped Japan, South Korea, Southeast Asia, Australia, Canada, and many other places. 2.5 centuries later, America is still a beacon. We should take pride in the generations of Americans who fought tyranny, defeated Nazism and fascism, defended democracy, welcomed millions, and answered the call to help nations facing war, disaster, and oppression. Our country has made mistakes abroad, but few nations have done more to advance human freedom and democratic values. None of this means Democrats must agree with every policy or action of every administration. Patriotism doesn't demand blind loyalty. It demands faith that our country is worth improving and confidence that our ideals are worth defending. That same spirit should guide our agenda at home, making America more affordable for working families, lowering the cost of health care and child care, protecting our seniors, and strengthening public schools are all part of the same American project. So are investing in infrastructure, science, and clean energy, supporting workers and small businesses, securing our borders while honoring our immigrant heritage, defending voting rights and equal justice, and upholding individual liberty and the rule of law. Together, these goals reflect a simple patriotic belief. America works best when communities are safe, opportunity is broad, and every citizen has a voice in the nation's future. We should reject both the politics of resentment on the right and ideological purity on the left. Americans are looking for practical solutions, not endless culture wars or litmus tests. The choice Democrats face is clear. We can allow patriotism to to become a partisan label, or we can reclaim a tradition that rightly belongs to every American. Mr. Swosey, a Democrat, represents New York's 3rd Congressional District. To close, there is an article on U.S. inventions, 250 years of innovation nationwide. Airplane flight, Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Assembly line, Detroit. Henry Ford's integration of moving parts and stationary labor revolutionized global manufacturing, turning the automobile from a luxury into a middle-class staple. Thomas Edison's light bulb, Menlo Park, New Jersey. Atomic energy, Los Alamos, New Mexico. The moon landing, Kennedy Space Center, Florida. Cotton gin, Eli Whitney's mechanical engine, exponentially increased production, cementing the South's economic power, and tragically entrenching the institution of slavery. Internet, Los Angeles. Refrigeration, Philadelphia. The stock ticker, New York City. Phillips screw, Portland, Oregon. The telephone, Boston. Alexander Graham Bell. Personal computer, Albuquerque, New Mexico. The software revolution was sparked, drawing a young Bill Gates and Paul Allen to start Microsoft. The steel plow, Grand Detour, Illinois. John Deere's self-polishing steel blade allowed settlers to slice through the sticky Midwest sod, unlocking the agricultural potential of the American heartland. Global Positioning System, Los Angeles. Originally a military project managed at the Los Angeles Air Force Base, this satellite-based precision timing changed how the world navigates. We close with words and music by Irving Berlin, 1938. While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair as we raise our voices in a solemn prayer. God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam, God bless America, my home, sweet home. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the July 2nd, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful, happy, safe 4th of July.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the Buffalo Criterion. At 8 o'clock, we have the New York Times. And at 9 o'clock, we have Discover Magazine. Stay with us for these readings and more. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability